Welcome back, guys, to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa. I am the host. Today, I have something very special for you all. I got to interview one of the foremost authorities in the nutrition space, Lane Norton. Lane holds a PhD in nutritional sciences and is a physique coach, natural bodybuilder, and quite the character on Instagram. In the first half of this episode, Lane dives deep into his background from schooling to pivoting into his career. We then go into the topic of muscle and fat loss. Lane discusses the importance of protein and weightlifting for improving one's body composition and increasing muscle mass. The second half of the episode is where we speak about energy balance, including the role that macronutrients and calories play in weight loss. I learned so much from this episode, especially when it comes to skeletal muscle and fat loss. Lane points out that skeletal muscle is a longevity organ.
We don't think about skeletal muscle as an organ, but it really is an organ. And it is a massive metabolic sink, I guess is the best way I can put it. If you have a lot of muscle, very hard to run high blood glucose, you know, high lipids, you know, you can, but, in general, you know, when you've got a lot of skeletal muscle and a lot of mitochondria, you know, you're churning through energy pretty good.
Welcome to the Neuro Experience Podcast, where you will learn the science of human performance and optimization. Guys, I am in Australia. I've come here to visit my parents. Now, for those of you following me, you've probably heard me talk about how my dad had a stroke 2 years ago. He suffered a right parietal lobe infarct, and it was quite scary. He is doing really well today in the recovery. But ever since then, this was back in late 2019, I've become obsessed with how can we heal the brain post-insult. And among the many things that we can do, one thing that I've been really experimenting with on myself for overall brain performance, but also for my father who really needs to heal his brain, is having exogenous ketones. Okay, so there is this new form of ketone that just came out. It's called Ketone IQ. It's the best type of ketones that I've ever consumed, and I've been talking about this so avidly because it is literally rocket fuel for the brain. And it's, I would say I'm completely at a loss here because I only discovered this about 2 months ago. So Ketone IQ is a drink, which it comes with 10 servings. And all you have to do is sip on these ketone esters per day. So this specific form or this specific drink is made by HVMN, the company. It's Health Via Modern Nutrition. And we often hear that fasting and exercise is good for the brain. And we know that in terms of healing the brain from trauma and overall brain performance. But the reason why is because when we push our body to its metabolic limits, we create nature's superfuel, which is ketones. But these ketones are able to cross the blood-brain barrier, and these ketone esters, I should say, and we're able to get into a state of ketosis even faster. So if you're like me and you want a better performing brain and you want that mental focus, sustained energy, sharpness, and be able to be in flow for many hours, you need to check this drink out. And if you struggle getting into nutritional ketosis, you can just take these ketone esters. They stack perfectly with other supplements, so you don't need to worry about that. And the best thing about all of this is this ketone drink, you can have it for 10% off using my code NEURO at checkout. You just have to go to hvmn.me/neuro and you'll get 10% off. But I'm also going to put the link below in the show notes. So this episode is brought to us by the best sleep fitness technology company, 8Sleep. All right, so let me break this down for you. It's freaking hot right now in California, in New York City, it's quite cold in Australia. So sleep is somewhat compromised in these temperatures. So I've been sleeping on an 8-sleep mattress for over 18 months now. And we all know that good sleep is the ultimate game changer and nature's best medicine. Did you know that getting a consistent good night's sleep can help reduce the likelihood of serious illnesses such as heart disease? It can lower blood pressure and even reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease. But what happens in these temperatures? We have something called polyphasic sleep, meaning we sleep in cycles because we wake up during the night. We wake up during to our temperature being overheated, which is what's happening to some people now in America. And then for me, I wake up because sometimes I'm feeling absolutely freezing. So the good news is you can now start sleeping even better and actually falling asleep even faster thanks to the 8-Sleep Pod Pro cover. So the 8-Sleep Pod Pro cover is the most advanced solution on the market for thermoregulation. It pairs dynamic cooling and heating with biometric tracking. So you can add this cover. I don't have the mattress, guys. I use the cover. I've got this cover and I put it on my mattress and I can sleep as cool as 55 degrees Fahrenheit or as hot as 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So they also do studies at 8-Sleep. They took a group of individuals and they put them through a sleep study. And what they found was users with the 8-Sleep Pod Pro cover are falling asleep up to 32% faster. They're reducing their sleep interruptions by 40%, and they're getting an overall better restful sleep. So with 30% more deep sleep, I can be confident, and so can you, that you're going to be waking up feeling fully recovered. You're going to have great hormonal regulation, and you're going to have fantastic mental clarity. If you want to be powered by 8-Sleep, go to 8sleep.com/Louisa, and you can get $150 off. Guess what? 8-Sleep now ships to the US, Canada, UK and Australia. So if you are listening to this down under, you can get yourself an 8-Sleep Pod Pro cover. You can save $150 off at checkout using code NEURO. So guys, if you like this episode, don't be shy. Go through and give us a review in Apple iTunes in the app. It literally takes 25 seconds to do. I hope you enjoy this one. Let's get into it. So Lane, I would love to start first of all with your background and understanding how you pretty much got to from where you were and crossed this academic path to doing what you do today.
I'll try to keep it as succinct as possible. So I grew up in Southern Indiana from not big enough to be a big town, not small enough to be a small town, and got picked on a lot, was really bullied pretty terribly throughout my school years, and got into lifting weights so that I would stop getting bullied and hopefully get some attention from girls. And lifting weights didn't do either of those two things, but I fell in love with lifting weights. And when I'd always known I'd wanted to be in the sciences, and I started out doing a biology degree at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. I'd always wanted to be in Florida. And as I was starting out that degree my freshman year, I was really getting into bodybuilding. I really wanted to try and compete in bodybuilding. And I had a really great general chemistry professor named Chris Schnabel. And he said, you know, like, he's very matter of fact, he said, you know, if you do a biology degree and then you don't go to grad school, you don't go to med school, you're just going to look like a med student who didn't get accepted to med school. So he said, what you really should do is biochemistry because you're into bodybuilding. Like that is bodybuilding. That's biochemistry. So I said, okay, I'll do biochemistry. So I got into doing that. And then I got into research, the summer after my sophomore and junior years. I did research with the organic chemistry professor there. And about my junior year, third year of university, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. So this is, I'm going to date myself. I'm 40 now, but this is back in 2003. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I just knew I wanted to be in the fitness industry somehow. But at that time, I mean, basically making a living in the fitness industry meant you were either competing at the Olympia. And I didn't want to take performance enhancing drugs. I've always been drug free. I wanted to stay that way. So that I felt like that was out. You could be a personal trainer. I really wasn't interested in that. You could own a supplement company. I didn't have a lot of capital. I had none. And, or you could, you know, start a gym. Those were kind of the options back then. And so I didn't really think that any of those were really options for me, but I kind of said, well, you know, I'll go to grad school because I can basically delay the real world for a few more years. And hopefully I won't be in the unemployment line with a master's or a PhD. And so I didn't know where to start. And, this was before social media, obviously. Because now so many academics are on social media, you can find some of the research you're interested in just by going to social media. So I just went to this new thing called PubMed at the time and typed in the stuff that I was interested in. I'll never forget. I put in leucine muscle protein synthesis. And the second paper that came up was a guy from a guy named Don Lehman at University of Illinois. And just by random chance, he was taking graduate students. And I got in, I got accepted. And turns out that he was a fantastic advisor, great mentor, and really made a huge difference in my career. And I studied protein metabolism, but during that whole time, I was getting into competing in bodybuilding, and I was also starting to write articles for bodybuilding.com. Just I'd been posting on their message boards and putting out a lot of free content, and I was already like circa 2004, 2005, I was already basically writing nutritional plans for people, just doing it for free, just because I loved doing it. And then once I got to grad school, I was kind of like, well, you know, I really should get paid for this. Just in terms of like, it was taking up my time. You know, maybe this means if I can make a little bit of money doing this, I don't have to take a teaching assistantship and I can, you know, just focus on my grad studies. And so that's what I did. I took my first client in 2005 for online nutrition coaching. This is before everyone on Instagram was a nutrition coach. And, you know, back then there was no competition. The most difficult thing was convincing people I could do it over the internet. And formed my company officially in 2007. And, you know, since then I've, personally coached over 2000 people, including people who like went to the Olympia and all that kind of stuff. Right down to, you know, people who lost 100 pounds. And, On the way there, also, like now, we have a nutrition coaching app. We have a supplement line. Written several books. Working on an accredited coaching course now. So yeah, we kind of
nutrition coaching course.
Yeah. Well, actually, so not just nutrition, but specifically for body composition. So right now, there are personal training certifications and there are nutrition certifications, but there's not really anything that like specifically focuses in on body composition. So basically everything you need to know for modifying body composition is going to be in this course. And and then like now we're about to launch any day now a monthly research review as well. So basically like trying to take complicated research and distill it down so that the average person can understand it. So yeah, it's been a heck of a ride.
It has been a heck of a ride. I love your thesis per se. And I love that you're doing this quote unquote journal club. And mainly because we are now seeing an abundance of people talking about quote unquote, you know, research articles, but you know, when I went to med school, we did a subject called clinical epidemiology, where we had to sit down and they spoke to us about the gold standard when it comes to academic research. And, you know, that's when I found out that you can actually pay somebody, like, or you can pay a journal $1,500. I think this was me as well, like way back in 2011 when I was learning about this. And they said, you know, there are high stringent journals and then there are just journals where you can pay the people $1,500 and you can put your research in there. So I love that you're going about it that way. And for everybody listening, you also have you just released an online ebook on how to read academic research?
Yeah. So to kind of celebrate the launch of our research review, we put together a 56-page ebook that we called the How to Read Research Guide. And you can get it for free for probably 24 more hours. members of our research review will get it for free, obviously. Basically, like, just trying to distill down, you know, basics of what to look for, you know, how to read research, what this stuff understands, some statistical basics, you know, because people don't even, like, right down to not even understanding the difference between, like, a narrative review and an actual research study. Like, I can't tell you the number of times people have cited mm-hmm. narrative reviews as evidence. And I'm like, you realize that this is just one big opinion, right? Like, that this is just an opinion piece. Now, it's better than, say, like, feelings, but it's still an opinion piece. And that's the same thing I tell people when I read research papers. The first thing I do, I don't read the introduction first. I read the results first. Then I read the methods. And then I read the discussion. And then I read the introduction. Now, that may seem really weird, but I want to see what the data says for myself before I get biased by anything that the researchers say, because the conclusions, the discussion, the introduction is more opinion-based, whereas the results are what they are. And I can't tell you the number of times I've read a research paper and I've read the results and then I read the conclusions of the authors and I go, that's not what your data said. So I think, and to your point, you know, all research isn't equal. And like the number of times I've seen people, you know, cite the, you know, European Journal of Clinical, you know, something or another, and kind of like to counter something in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I'm kind of like, you know, these two things are definitely not equal, you know, like, not saying that bad research never gets published in good journals, because it does from time to time. But it's just about the confidence level, right? And I mean, again, to your point, there are predatory journals who you can pay money to. And there was a researcher, just to prove a point, who basically just took a section out of a book that had nothing to do with anything with research, just a random book, sent the text in, and they published it in the journal. Like
because he paid,
because
for,
he paid
it.
For it. They didn't even check it. They just published it. Wow. So and even right down to, like, I've seen, you know, people have big social media followings who are doctors or have doctorates, and you go and find out that they got their, you know, degree from a degree mill, unaccredited degree mill that they, you know, took a 6-week course and got. So unfortunately, that, you know, the average person is just not really well equipped to, one, determine, like, hey, this was a research paper in vitro with a knockout model using a huge amount of X, you know, it's not the same thing as a human randomized control trial. You know, they're different. So,
yeah, I think it's also when you talk about that, the difference between animal models and human studies, and there's, you know, because people think, well, but Louisa, this was a randomized control trial. It's like, but we, at the end of the day, we are not mice. We are not rats. So some of the things cannot be transferred over. And with what I focus on, neurology and neuroscience, there's just this huge argument around neurogenesis, which, you know, is really only proven in rat models. So it's, there has been studies, you know, to suggest that it could happen in humans. But right now it's like, you know, people, it's just, I see it everywhere. Do this and you grow new neurons. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
It's so I understand that as well. But I love following you. And I think you're a pillar of education when it comes to social media. And we're going to get into that. So this is how I'm thinking of going through this podcast. So I would love to base it on first muscle and weightlifting, and then I want to move on to diet. Okay. So I really want to separate the two. And let's start with when you were doing your graduate studies and also now, what did you learn about when it came to building muscle and losing fat? Because I think that is the big, that is, even with me, you know, being a woman, I'm always trying to do that, build muscle, lose fat, and it just doesn't work out for me.
So I learned a lot, but a lot of the, you know, it's funny when you get into the the discussions that are always stimulating for scientists are the stuff that's in the 1%, you know, the margins. Well, but the 99% usually ends up just going back to basics, you know, basic stuff that people think is really boring, you know. So, you know, what I learned when it comes to, you know, resistance training, I think the first thing to point out is that resistance training, when I first got into it, there was a big stigma around it in terms of, well, you're a meathead or you're going to be muscle bound, or, you know, with women, you'll get bulky. Resistance training makes you better at pretty much anything you do as long as you keep doing it. That goes for sports. That goes for, you know, health. It's one of the healthiest, if not the healthiest thing you can do for yourself. And it doesn't take an incredibly high dose either. You know, even 3 sessions of 45 minutes a week, you know, will significantly improve your lean body mass and your strength. And I think one of the things I really took away from looking at the research literature is we don't think about skeletal muscle as an organ, but it really is an organ because, and it, per weight, it's our largest organ in our body. And it is a massive metabolic sink, I guess is the best way I can put it. If you have a lot of muscle, very hard to run high blood glucose, you know, high lipids, you know, you can, but in general, you know, when you've got a lot of skeletal muscle and a lot of mitochondria, you know, you're churning through energy pretty good. So, you know, having more muscle really gives you a large buffer when it comes to, you know, other things in terms of, you know, staying healthy. So that's the first thing.
And just on that, when you say a buffer for glucose, that's because it's a storage unit. Are you saying so? As soon as you eat something, the more muscle you have, it becomes a dumping ground for all of the glucose. So the more muscle you have, the better you will be with managing your glucose levels and those insulin.
Definitely
spikes.
For, you know, obviously if you have more muscle, you have more capacity for muscle glycogen, but not just that. You know, you have more overall GLUT4 receptors. You also have more mitochondria. So when you resistance train, you don't just increase the contractile tissue, you also increase mitochondrial protein synthesis as well. So it's not just the contractile proteins. And you have an overall remodeling of the muscle tissue. And it's muscle protein synthesis increases in response to lifting weights, and actually so does muscle protein breakdown. But obviously synthesis exceeds breakdown. And so when you're doing that, you're creating kind of this like futile cycle where, you know, you're just having more turnover in general. Well, that turnover is energetically expensive, you know, requires energy. So when you're having to create more ATP, you're having to go through more glucose to do that. You have more mitochondria. So it kind of creates, like I said, this sink where, you know, if you're, I'm going to really overgeneralize, and I'm sure there's some people with, you know, who are experts on the Krebs cycle who are just going to cringe. But, you know, essentially, if you're, you know, churning through this energy, it is going to pull via flux more glucose through. So again, it's going to help, you know, get rid of, you know, excess blood glucose or what would have been excess blood glucose. And also muscle tissue tends to be pretty greedy if you're using it. So, you know, it's less, it's less substrate that can go to adipose tissue. So, you know, and you see this even in people who, you know, all things being equal in terms of body fat levels, if you have two people, both at like say 20% body fat, but one person has significantly more lean mass. And again, we're assuming genetically identical. One person has significantly more lean mass. In general, they're going to have better health markers than the person who's under-muscled.
Yeah. And there's so many studies that relates to resistance training and brain health as well, the amount of myokines that you release during, like, irisin is something that that I've been focusing on lately, like irisin, lactate, IGF-1, obviously. And this is, there's a difference between these myokines that are released during muscle-based activities like resistance training compared to aerobic training. Because when you think of aerobic training for brain health, you just think of BDNF. But there are so many, I think the benefits of resistance training outweigh the benefits of cardiovascular fitness and training as it relates to brain health. So I'm really big on that too. So, okay, so where are we going wrong when it comes to this whole ethos of losing fat and building muscle, especially as it relates to women?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think the first thing is, when it comes to building muscle, I think a lot of women are afraid to train hard. Now, that's much less than it used to be. And again, but I still get the whole, you know, I don't want to get too bulky. Listen, if you're not taking performance-enhancing drugs, it is going to be very difficult as a woman to look too muscular. I mean, unless you are just genetically elite. And guess what? If you are, then once you start getting too muscled, back off your lifting. It's not a complicated equation, but you know, that's like saying, well, you know, I don't want to get in my car and drive to work because I'm afraid I might be a NASCAR driver. It's like, it's not going to happen randomly, you know, like this is something that you would see occurring. And like I said, in general, you know, like, for example, my wife is like one of the most, hardworking, but also genetically gifted people I've ever seen.
Yeah, she looks absolutely fantastic. Right. Like, she posts photos of her in her bikinis and it upsets me.
So, you know, what I would say is most women, there are some women who'd probably say, oh, that's a little bit too much for me. But I think most women would say, oh, I really like her physique. Like, her physique is, you know, very toned and, you know, still feminine. She goes hard. Like, you know, she's deadlifted, you know, over 150 kilos. She squatted, you know, almost 130 kilos, you know, so she's very strong and she goes hard. In fact, I tell people, I'm like, you know, whenever they accuse her of performance enhancing drugs, I'm like, well, why don't you just come lift with her in the gym one day and you'll see what I mean. So I think what I would say to the women is like, don't fear going hard. Like, you're, it's very unlikely that you're going to, you know, gain too much muscle. I have spent my entire adult life trying to get too big. And in a t-shirt, I look like somebody who's athletic. You know what I mean? Like, if you're not taking performance enhancing drugs, for the most part, you don't have to worry about that. Now, go ahead.
I was going to just ask about what your stance is on a lot of the studies that are done. You know, there's this theory that most studies are done on men. Therefore, you know, and women at the end of the day, women menstruate, men don't. And therefore, hormonal changes happen, you know, especially as it relates to exercise. So where is your stance on that? And do you, when you are coaching somebody, do you really take that into account?
So the first thing I'll say is, women are not small men. However, from a muscle growth perspective, what we see is that relative to their starting lean mass, women are able to gain the same amount of muscle as men as a percentage of their starting lean mass. So for example, let's say somebody can gain 10% or 20% more lean mass than they start with. Well, if I start with, you know, 70 kilograms of lean mass, that means I could put on 14 kilograms. Now, don't get tied up in these numbers. I'm pulling these out of thin air. But if somebody starts with 40 kilograms lean mass, that means if they add 8 kilos of lean mass, they've added the same amount of muscle as a percentage of their starting lean mass. So when I say women can add the same amount of muscle as men, that's what I'm referring to. And actually strength too. So when they look at, you know, the strength gains, for people who resistance train, again, as a percentage of their beginning strength, women are able to gain about the same amount of strength as men. And interestingly, it does appear that women may recover a little bit faster than men from resistance training, in terms of, like delayed onset muscle soreness and also, just, you know, getting back to, like, if they measure like their strength from session to session, their strength recovery appears that it might be a little bit faster. So that's one thing I'll say. As far as programming around their cycle, I tend to be very pragmatic about this. I don't necessarily change things around a female client's cycle. However, I'm a fan of auto-regulation in general. So I might say to somebody, you know, if you're familiar with the RPE scale or RIR, so RPE refers to rate of perceived exertion. We use a scale of 1 to 10. So 10 being you could not have done another repetition with a given weight. And RIR is just the inverse. So RIR is repetitions in reserve. So an RPE of 10 is an RIR of 0. RPE of 9 is an RIR of 1, so on and so forth. So I might say to somebody, you know, today you're working up to a squat with, you know, to 8 repetitions at an RPE of 7 or an RIR of 3. So you're leaving 3 in the tank. Well, depending on how they feel on that day, that may be 100 kilos, that may be 90 kilos, right? So if you use the principles of auto-regulation, you don't necessarily need to change, in my opinion, how you're programming around that person's cycle, because I think you should auto-regulate in general anyway, because some things are very random as well. Like, I'll give you a great example. Last night I got really bad sleep. Like, I was up probably 4 or 5 times. And then I've been feeling like my throat's been a little bit scratchy, you know. So today I was supposed to have a heavy bench press session, and I'm already like preparing myself. I'm like, all right, it's probably not going to go like I wanted to go. And of course it was like flying. So, you know, absolutely made no sense. So if I had said, well, you know, on a night where I don't get good sleep, I'm going to, you know, back the weight off. Well, I would have missed out on actually a good session. But since I auto-regulate anyway, you know, I was supposed to work up to an RPE 7 single today. It was like, okay, well, I did my first single and it was an RPE 6 because I track bar velocity because I'm a nerd. So I know what my bar velocity looks like at different RPEs. But if you do this long enough, you can kind of have a good idea of like, okay, you know, that felt like this, or I probably had this many left. And so since I'm doing that anyway, if I had felt horrible, you know, maybe warming up, I go, okay, you know, that my last warm up really felt awful. You know, we're going to back it off by, you know, 5-10 kilos today to hit that RPE or RIR number. So I do agree that you should auto-regulate, but I think you should auto-regulate in general and not just necessarily based on somebody's cycle, because I have had women who absolutely, like, they get premenstrual or they get, you know, into their cycle and they're in a lot of pain. My wife, you know, really struggles with this, and she usually will back off during, you know, those times. But I've also had other women who are like, you know, I actually feel pretty good right now in the gym, even though, like, I, you know, this, you know, this isn't very comfortable. I think that it can be auto-regulated, but I think training should be auto-regulated in general anyway. So hopefully that kind of answers the question.
Well, yeah, it just reminds me of so many people now are wearing wearables, and this auto-regulation can be somewhat comparable to HRV. People are getting up and they're seeing their Oura Ring data or their Whoop data, and they're like, oh, I'm in the red zone. I shouldn't train hard today, but then they feel good. And it's like, but if you feel good, then why are you trusting the wearable to tell you what to do? But then in other days, it's, you know, your wearable could say that you're in the green zone, but you could just be feeling horrible. So I think the best measure is what you just said. It's really, how do you feel?
Yeah, that's great.
And using that auto-regulation.
And this brings in like, so this actually brings in a great discussion of like a surrogate measurement versus a hard outcome. Right. So I compete in powerlifting. I'm getting ready for nationals right now. My hard outcome is how much weight am I lifting on a day? Right. And how quickly is it moving? Well, your Oura Ring, your HRV, your Barvelot, those are all surrogate measurements. Now, they may trend a certain way, and you may be able to say, okay, usually when this is doing this, I can expect this. But you don't want to nocebo yourself either, which does happen. So what you just said, you wake up, your Oura Ring says you didn't sleep well. Oh, you know, I'm probably not going to have a good session today. And so guess what happens? Since you have already put that in your mind, well, you know, we've already known, like, and you know, as a based on your background, the power of suggestion is, I mean, basically as powerful as drugs. You know, mm-hmm. if you put that, if that's what your belief is, that will probably be the outcome. So what I'll always mm-hmm. say is like, what do we care about more? Do we care about this surrogate measurement that isn't measuring performance? It's just measuring some other things that may be indicative. Or do we care about what actually is happening when we go to train? So again, now, that being said, you know, a great example is I compile all this stuff, right? So, all right, last night I didn't have good sleep. Now, if I had gone in and my warmups felt really bad, my bar velocity was slow, you know, all that kind of stuff, then I can be pretty confident that, okay, you know what, today we don't have it. We're going to back it off. But if I'm going in and I'm, you know, and my only one variable says I didn't get good sleep and my HRV is a little bit off, but then my, you know, the bar is moving well, my velocity is good, the warmups felt fine, which one is the more indicative measurement? I would argue that the actual hard outcome is, right? So that's, again, like we could get into people like focusing on the wrong things with fat loss, for example. People all the time say, look at this study that showed, you know, this weird thing increased fat oxidation. And I'm like, you realize fat oxidation is not the same thing as fat loss, like the actual loss of body fat. Yeah. People don't know that, you know, like, so fat loss is the balance between fat storage and fat oxidation. By the way, both processes are occurring at the same time, and it is the relative rates of each that determine the loss or gain of body fat over time. So, sorry, I'm kind of segueing into fat loss, and then we can kind of take it from there. But, you know, one of the things I'll hear is, like, for example, fasted cardio, it increases fat oxidation. Great. So if it actually causes more fat loss, when we look at studies that do fasted cardio versus the same amount of fed cardio, we should see differences in fat loss. But we don't. And we have numerous studies to show this. So I always tell people, now that doesn't mean that you shouldn't do fasted cardio. Like if somebody is strapped for time and they want to get up, do it first thing, maybe they just prefer it that way. Hey, totally reasonable. But I'm sorry, it doesn't cause more fat loss. And we have a multitude of studies to show this. And what we think is happening is since you're oxidizing more fat during your workout because you're fasted, well, by being fasted for a certain period of time, if we're equating calories between these two different protocols, because we have to do that to see if one is more effective than the other, that means you're eating more calories, you know, later in the day. So guess what happens to fat oxidation the rest of the day? It's reduced. Whereas if you ate before your session, that leaves less calories the remainder of the day. And so your fat oxidation is actually going to be a little bit higher the rest of the day. The net effect is zero. And then we can, you know, kind of use that same segue into like low carb diets versus higher carb diets. People will.
Well, before we do, I want to ask you, just staying on the morning thing, because I did have a question here regarding this crazy misunderstood hormone. We call it cortisol. And so I want to know, obviously I'm a woman, so I'm always talking about from a female perspective, but it's for everybody. Wouldn't training on an empty stomach or fasted training increase more cortisol than, so I was talking to Dr. Stacey Sims, and she was the one who, you know, put out women are not small men. And she says that women shouldn't be doing fasted weightlifting or fasted resistance training, because when you wake up and you're in a fasted state and you're already having an increase in cortisol. Therefore, when you go to the gym and you do your weights, you're just going to double up on that cortisol. So she recommends going to the gym after you've eaten or doing a weight session after you've eaten.
So I think practically I agree with her recommendations, but I'm going to disagree with the reasoning for the recommendation. So first off, there is some evidence that training in a fed state is superior for resistance training when it comes to performance and possibly hypertrophy. Now, that's probably more due to energy availability. When it comes to cortisol, I think people make way too big of a deal out of the short-term rises and falls of hormones as they relate to exercise. So you may recall probably 10, 15 years ago, it was very popular to say to people, well, you know, a growth hormone goes up and testosterone goes up and cortisol goes up after like an hour of training. So you should probably just limit your training to an hour. And this was kind of the hormone hypothesis for muscular hypertrophy. But if you understand how these hormones work, cortisol, testosterone, These are more long-term hormones. The short-term rises and falls in these hormones are much more driven by energy availability or by energy mobilization than they are anything to do with hypertrophy, because these hormones, it's not like they're not hormones like insulin. You know, insulin binds to a receptor on the cell surface and the response is virtually instantaneous. It's very quick. With testosterone and cortisol, these are steroid hormones, so they're binding to a receptor, and then they are exerting their effects by affecting transcription of DNA. Those transcripts, first off, there's quite a bit of, you know, just because you increase transcription does not necessarily mean you're going to get an outcome. So that's one thing. Second thing is it takes time for those transcripts to build up. So what I default to, again, is kind of the hard outcomes, right? So there's actually a really great paper that I pulled up and I'm going to read from right now. This was by out of Stu Phillips' lab. And Stu Phillips is the number one researcher in the world for exercise, protein metabolism, resistance training. He is the most cited researcher in the world, and he does excellent research. So this was a paper from 2012. And so what they did was they looked at 12 weeks of resistance training, and they attempted to correlate the changes in strength and hypertrophy and changes in cross-sectional area, which is actually really important because cross-sectional area is a much more direct measurement of hypertrophy than, say, like a DEXA, which is just lean mass, which includes like water and some other tissues, not just skeletal muscle. And so they were looking at these transient changes in hormones, and how, you know, did they correlate with strength, hypertrophy? What they found was that growth hormone, testosterone, and systemic IGF-1 had absolutely no association with muscle growth. Interestingly, cortisol actually had a significant positive association with muscular hypertrophy. Now, cortisol is not anabolic, but what are the sort of training protocols that are going to increase muscle mass? Well, they're going to be challenging, they're going to be very hard, and they're going to be very stressful, which is also going to increase cortisol. Which is why, again, I don't necessarily disagree with her recommendation. I would just disagree with the reasoning for it, because I just don't think short-term rises and falls in cortisol really mean that much. I think that they're really overblown. And I would say the same thing about, you know, short-term rises and falls in testosterone and growth hormone. They just don't appear to really do much.
So when you say the exercise needs to be significantly hard, are you referring to, let's just say, 70% of 1 RM?
So this is a great question, which gets into kind of like progressive overload and volume and like what makes an effective resistance training session. And I actually just re-looked over this literature. So when it comes to muscular hypertrophy specifically, there's so many ways to skin a cat. We know that mechanical tension is important. We know that metabolic stress is probably important. And we know that progressive overload is important. You have to keep increasing the stimulus in some way. Now, people hear the word progressive overload and they think, well, I just have to keep getting stronger. No, you can progressively overload by doing more reps, doing more sets, more volume. There's multiple ways. Now, when it comes to like how hard should it be, it's not necessarily a weight thing or a percentage of 1 RM. Now, for a long time, it was recommended by, and even still to this day, several like highbrow accredited personal training courses will say you need to have at least 65% of your one rep max in order to, you know, increase muscular hypertrophy. We simply know that that's not true. They have shown that light loads taken to close to failure will produce similar hypertrophy outcomes as heavy loads. Now, if you want to get stronger, like, and when I say strength, the purest expression of strength is a one rep max, then you do need to use sufficiently heavy loads because strength is a specific skill. But when it comes to purely muscular hypertrophy, as long as you're basically staying below 30 reps and taking it close to failure within a few reps of failure, It appears that really what matters is kind of the number of hard sets. And when we say, what is a hard set? This is hotly debated, but I would say taking it within at least 5 repetitions of failure. Now, people will hear that and people will say, oh, well, that doesn't sound very hard. Well, I think the majority of training should be about 2 to 3 reps away from failure. Most people who say 2 to 3 reps away from failure, especially on like compound exercises, if somebody says that's easy, they've never actually taken a lift to failure. I mean, a great example is I've done a set where my best like all time like high rep squat was like 480 pounds for 14 reps. When I finished that set, I was so fatigued, I couldn't re-rack the weight. Like I have one side that dips a little bit lower. Somebody had to run from across the gym to help me re-rack it because I literally could not lock out my lower back enough to rack the weight. And then I crumpled down into a heap and my heart rate was almost 200. And I laid there for about 15 minutes before I felt like I could move. Okay. So you're telling me if I stop 2 reps shy of that, that's an easy set. Like, so I'll just tell people like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, that's still considered a very hard set. So when it comes to looking at muscular hypertrophy, you know, really making sure that you're taking sets to close enough to failure. Now, taking it all the way to failure is probably, you know, doing that often is probably, one, it's not necessary. We show that getting within a couple reps of failure basically produces the same outcomes as failure and probably with less systematic fatigue. So I'm not saying you can never train to failure. I don't want people to strawman my argument, but I think that, you know, doing it too often is probably unnecessary and probably will accumulate too much fatigue and you might start to see performance decrements over time. But I think the big take-home message is when they look in research, especially with people who are new to resistance training, they drastically, not a little bit, drastically underestimate their RPEs. So they'll do, researchers will have them do a weight. And I might butcher this study. I don't think so. But there was one study where they had them like pick a weight and do it. And they had them estimate their RPE. They were like 5 or over off their RPE when they had them take it to failure. So like, again, especially with people who are new to resistance training, they don't really know how to push. That's not like a slam. That's just fact. And even people who have been resistance training a while, I remember when my wife first moved over, my wife's Australian. So when she first moved over.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't know
Holly was Australian.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So you're used to this
accent
then?
Yeah, I didn't even notice.
Wow.
Yeah, she's originally from Tasmania and lived in Melbourne and also in Gold Coast. So when she first moved over, she was kind of used to, well, I'll slap a plate on each side and I'll squat for 10 reps and I'll, you know, I work up a good sweat and it feels hard. And she would see me like do a set of 2 reps and then sit down for like 8 to 10 minutes. And she's like, Why are you resting so much? Like that doesn't look like it was hard. You just did 2 reps. And I was like, yeah, it's like 90% of my 1 rep max. It's extremely fatiguing. Like it's very mentally draining as well. And then she did a prep for a powerlifting meet and she was like, whoa, I never understood how hard this really was. And I also never understood that like my perception of hard when it comes to like a workout was basically how much I was sweating and I didn't really have a good idea how to push myself. And her going through that training, she said, you know, she would never do powerlifting again just because she hated the way she felt so beat up. But she said that it was really great for teaching her how to push and really like understand what a hard set is. So again, not a slam towards women or people who are new to resistance training. It's just whatever you think you are able to do, you probably can actually do more than that. So
is this why sometimes you'll find – sorry to cut you in, but sometimes you find people who are maybe training really hard at the gym and they're doing ways, but their body isn't changing. And they're like, no matter what I do, my body composition just doesn't train. And I train weights, you know, 3 or 4 times a week.
Absolutely. Okay. You have to get uncomfortable. And that goes for anything in life. You know, like if you want to progress your business, you're going to have to take some risks and get uncomfortable. If you want to push your knowledge to another level, you're going to have to get uncomfortable and learn some new things. You know, like this is just the way it works. It's progressive overload in anything. And it's the same thing with the gym. If you continue to do, you know, I was talking to somebody and I was like, you know, when was the last time you just went in and said, I'm going to purposely add 5 pounds to the bar, or, you know, 2.5 kilos to the bar? I don't know. I just kind of do the same thing. And I'm like, well, that's why you're not changing. You know, why would your body change? You're not giving it the impetus to change. You have to create that that need, because at the end of the day, skeletal muscle remodeling and hypertrophy is a stress response. You are imposing a stress that your body is responding by saying, oh man, that was hard. We almost couldn't handle that. We're going to adapt so that we can handle it better. That's what you're doing. So you have to create that impetus for it. So getting people to understand how to train hard. So honestly, that's a big one. I mean, I Mike Israetel had a great post a few days ago. I don't know if you're familiar with Mike Israetel, but he has a PhD in exercise physiology. And a few months ago, he posted, he said, you know, a lot of people will try and kind of science their way out of hard training. You know, they'll do these little hacks and like they're tracking all these metrics. But you can't science your way out of hard training. You still like have to get uncomfortable. That's what it boils down to. And it also has to be something that's done for a long time. Our bodies, you know, aren't Amazon Prime. It's not going to show up in you know, this afternoon, unfortunately. And I think really that's what we deal with a lot now is people aren't used to delayed gratification because we don't have to do it in very many areas of our life. And so, you know, if people think fat loss is a slow process, oh boy, you're going to be really disappointed with muscle growth, because muscle growth is an incredibly slow process. And I'll just give you guys a little bit of perspective. When I first started lifting, I didn't really take leg training seriously because it was hard. and then once I decided I was going to compete in bodybuilding, I started taking it seriously. And I trained really hard and I just expected that my legs were going to grow like the rest of me. Turns out I didn't have great genetics for building legs. And after 3 years of really hard training, they just didn't look very good. But it would have been very easy for me to say, well, you know, see, I just don't have it. This isn't for me. I'm going to do something else. But I kept at it. 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 In fact, I remembered saying to myself, you know what? One day I'm going to squat 500 pounds. This is actually how I got into powerlifting. I said, I'm going to squat 500 pounds for reps because, you know, there might be somebody out there who has small legs who squatted 500 pounds for reps, but I sure haven't met them yet. So I made that my goal, did that, and sure enough, my legs weren't small by the time I did it. And, you know, it took, I'll never forget, I was actually prepping for a bodybuilding show shortly after that. And I was practicing my posing in front of one of the Federation's judges. And I said, you know, I know my legs are a weak point, so I'm like doing some stuff to try and hide it. And she said, your legs aren't a weak point. And I remembered thinking, what? from the time I had started training hard, it took me over a decade to get to that point. And then I actually at one point set a squat world record, 303 kilos at 93 kilo body weight with just knee sleeves and a belt. And that had been 17 years after I'd started training hard. So here's the other, you know, boring fact that people don't realize with resistance training. It takes a long time, especially if you don't have great genetics for it. So, you know, just relentless, brutal, obnoxious consistency is the magic sauce. One of my favorite quotes is, the magic you're looking for is then the work you're attempting to avoid. Yeah. So there's a few meta-analyses on this now. So I'm going to give you the straight down the line what the research says, and then I'll give you my personal opinion, because we have to remember that research studies are really constrained, and it's very difficult to get research studies that last longer than 12 weeks that are randomized controlled. Because one, exercise physiology doesn't get a lot of funding. So that's one thing to keep in mind. You know, it's not cancer, it's not insulin resistance, they're not getting big funding. And when people always ask, well, why didn't they do more subjects and why didn't they do it for longer? The answers to your questions are money, money, and money, because that stuff costs money. The more control you're going to try to exert over somebody's life, you have to pay people. You have to pay people to do like really rigidly controlled trials. I know people don't realize this, but money for studies doesn't fall from trees. So it's really difficult to get studies that are more than 12 weeks when we look at resistance training. So that's the first caveat. The meta-analyses seem to suggest that for upper body specifically, a frequency of 2 times a week appears to be better than 1 time per week per muscle group. Lower body, they didn't see differences. Now, I don't think that there's magic between the two. I think that this is probably lost in noise. I think that if you injected me with truth serum and asked my honest opinion, I would say that I think 2 times a week is better than 1 time. And there's some mechanistic data to support that as well. Like we know that the muscle protein synthesis response, the anabolic response to a resistance training session, is about 24 to 72 hours max. And it actually gets shorter and shorter the more experienced you get with resistance training. And once again, most of these studies are not on people who are very, very experienced resistance trainers. So I would hazard a guess that your frequency matters less when you start because you're going to have such a robust response to the stimulus. And as you progress, you will probably need to add volume. And it appears to be mostly volume driven in terms of like what appears to be driving hypertrophy. So just, you know, doing more of it. But frequency is a wonderful way to distribute volume. So there was a meta-analysis, I think by James Krieger, where they looked at number of sets per week per body part. And basically his conclusion was, we haven't really found an upper limit for muscle growth for sets per body part per week. But, you know, you're not going to do 40 sets in a single session, and I wouldn't recommend doing that. And the research suggests that the anabolic cap to a session is around 6 to 10 sets per body part, if they're sufficient in difficulty. It's a little bit lower number of sets if you rest longer. It's a little bit higher number of sets if you rest shorter. And that's probably just completely because if you rest longer, you're able to exert more, you're able to perform better on each individual set and create more overload. So that's probably why there's that difference there. So getting back to your original question, I would say for most people, first off, do what you can be consistent with. If you can't get in each body part 2 times a week, it's fine. I would prioritize with the frequency that the body parts you maybe want to focus on. And you can always cycle through those. So maybe like you say, you know, I can really only get in 3 times a week. So I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to focus on legs. So I'm going to do legs 2 times a week and upper body 1 time a week, right? And then maybe you do that for, you know, a certain period of time. And then you can switch to doing upper body for 2 times a week and legs 1 time a week. So, you know, you really, the programming wise, studies can provide guidelines, but really the world is your oyster when it comes to how you program this stuff, because there's an infinite number of ways to program. And I would say the same thing that I say with nutrition, which is, you know, consistency, consistent application trumps everything else. So find something that you'll be consistent with. And here's the other one that you enjoy, because if you enjoy it, you'll work harder at it and you're more likely to be consistent with it. If you say, well, this, you know, the study said I need to do X, Y, Z, so I'm going to do it, but you hate it, like, you know, you're not going to be consistent with it. So that has to be the base that we form with anything. I mean, a great example is people say, well, Lane, you know, can I grow muscle with CrossFit? And I'll say, yeah, you can grow muscle with CrossFit. Is it as good for growing muscle as pure bodybuilding training or strength training? Probably not. But if you enjoy it and it's something that you're more likely to be consistent with, then maybe it is better for you as an individual. So again, consistency trumps all. But if we're talking about theoretical best practices, I would say 2 times a week, 6 to 10 sets per body part. And if you become really advanced, you may get some benefits from moving to a frequency of 3 times a week. Obviously, that begins to get difficult if you're trying to do that for every body part. So I recommend, focusing specific periods of time on specific body parts that you want to prioritize and doing those with increased frequency and volume, and then possibly cycling through different periods of time where you do that for different body parts.
You know, just listening to you, everything seems it has to be a deliberate. There has to be a deliberate effort in what you're doing when you go to the gym or do any form of exercise. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is I'm seeing that right now in society, everybody is, it's got to be individualized. So meaning that my goals in my early 30s are completely different from my father's, who is 70 years old. He had a stroke 2 years ago. So we are now trying to get him on a different type of training protocol than what I'm on. So in saying that, what I see is that there is a bunch of people, you know, when I go back to Sydney, my apartment is located next to an F45, and I walk past it on my morning walk, and I just see various different age groups, which is fine. It's like you've got your young kids and you've got your older adults, really big people, then really athletic people. And it's like, well, it shouldn't be a one size fits all approach when it comes to training. Everybody's different. And what you were just mentioning, you know, with the sets and the reps and the time, et cetera, that's really dependent on your goals and your needs, because I don't think my father would benefit from this as much as maybe doing 3 hours a week of zone 2 training, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I want to be clear, like, you know, people doing some form of activity is better than nothing. Absolutely. So I don't want people to think, oh, well, you know, I don't go heavy, you know, I don't train to failure. This is all a waste of time. No, it's absolutely better than doing nothing. There's no question about that. So I always try to relate things back to, like, what are we comparing it to? Right. But I think, you know, you brought up a good point, intentional, and kind of like having, I like structured flexibility when it comes to training and nutrition. So I like to have a good idea of what I'm going to do, but then I like to be flexible enough that I can change it if I need to. And that can be, you know, a lot of this stuff should be based on personal preference. And I feel like that does not get talked about nearly enough. That is one of the major, major determinants of long-term consistency and adherence. And that, to me, is the biggest, the biggest determinant of success is, do you do it for a really long period of time consistently? So I'll give a great example. I was actually reading my partner, Bill Campbell. He's a professor at USF in exercise physiology. He's helping me write this course that we're going to be doing. And he was covering the high load versus low load training. And, you know, some people prefer high load training. That's like me. I love lifting heavy. I love it. But there's definite downsides to that. You got to rest longer between sets. You might get, you know, a little more aches and pains, you know, that sort of thing. But there's negatives to low load training too, in terms of people rate much higher levels of discomfort taking low load sets to near failure compared to high load sets. Now, some individuals may prefer that. They love the pump. They love the pump. Sorry, I went into my Arnold voice. They love the pump. They, you know, really enjoy that discomfort. But some people don't enjoy that discomfort. Well, just because the research says that there's no difference in hypertrophy between, you know, 2 to 30 reps, doesn't mean that we shouldn't encourage variety. One, to mentally stimulate people. Two, because, you know, there are benefits to training in a lower rep range in terms of strength. And three, because we'll find that person's personal preference. And, you know, if it improves their adherence, that's great. You know, it's the same thing. Like if I take, you know, we know even with like frail elderly can put on significant muscle mass if we start resistance training. I mean, when I say resistance training, it might be just them squatting like to a high chair to start with, you know. But, you know, I'm not going to take a 60-year-old woman who it's her first time in the gym and say, okay, well, we're starting with free bar squats and deadlifts today. Like that's going to be really like horrible way to introduce them to the gym, yeah. You know? So like that. Now, does the research say that she would get just as many benefits from those exercises as other people? Sure. But that is an intimidating way to start in the gym. She's going to feel super awkward because the first time anybody puts a barbell on their back, it is not an intuitive movement. There's better ways to do it. So I completely agree. Like, individualization is so important, but I think where people, I'm really big on explaining why stuff works because I don't want people to draw weird associations in their heads. I think that when people will say, well, you know, I tried all these things and I finally found this and this worked for me. And they think it's a physiological difference, that they're somehow physiologically different. What I'll tell people is, yeah, there's people who have polymorphisms on genes that change things, all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, we're like 99.9% genetically identical. Like, the differences are very, very subtle, right? And so what a lot of times happen is people just find something that they really like. And they just all of a sudden that consistency kicks in, you know, and they don't even realize it because it feels so easy because it's so much fun to them. Or same thing with diet. Like, mm-hmm. I'll hear all the time, I tried every diet, but intermittent fasting, I just didn't feel hungry. It felt easy. Well, if you look at the research says that there's no difference in adherence between intermittent fasting and other diets on average. But that doesn't mean for an individual that some individuals will find it much easier. And for them, absolutely. Like, do that, you know? But the problem is people don't like saying that it's just personal preference for some crazy reason. I still don't understand it.
It's Instagram.
We want to do what
others are doing. And we want to look like everybody else on there.
Yeah. So they come up with, well, it's, you know, it's insulin and autophagy and all these sorts of things. And it's like, yeah, but the randomized control trials though, you know, like, you know, I always tell people like don't neglect personal preference. That is if you like doing something better than something else, that is a completely reasonable reason to do it. Just don't assume that everybody is going to like it like you will.
All right, let's shift gears and talk about food and diet, because I know that this is what you're, you know, pretty much basing your business on. You're going to be having a course on it, like you said. I can't wait till that's out. And diet, as compared to exercise, is completely different for me. So I used to be an elite triathlete. So I always say that this was 40 pounds ago. Literally. But we got taught something back. You know, I was racing hard. We were doing about 30 races a year. And then I was training hard. I was training around 40 hours a week. And it was a lot on my body. And I was eating now. When I look back, I'm like, oh my God, I was eating the wrong foods. You know, we got told carb load and eat all of this. So I was always, you know, I never had equal ground when it came to training and nutrition. And right now I'm Greek. I eat, you know, everything. I'm not a vegan. I'm not just solely, I like to live well. And that's how we celebrate really in our culture. So it's always been fascinating to me, this world of energy, calories and nutrition. So before we begin, do you subscribe to any type of diet, or are you just do you eat everything?
I'm a whatever works kind of guy when it comes to the individual and their goals.
Yeah.
I eat – the best way I can describe my diet is the basis of it is I do, as a tool, track my calories and my protein, my carb, my fat intake. That's something that I've found to be not very difficult for me. And feels much less restrictive for me than saying, well, you're not going to eat carbs or you're going to restrict your feeding window. Again, not saying that those aren't useful tools, but for me, tracking was felt like the least restrictive tool. And I'm sure we'll get to this, but I always tell people, if you want to lose fat or maintain a lean physique, it's going to require some form of restriction. But you get to pick the form of restriction, and you should pick the form of restriction that feels the least restrictive to you. Because if you're picking the one that feels the like maximally restrictive, whenever you get stressed out, it's all going to go out the window. So no, I wouldn't say that I subscribe to any particular kind of eating. If you look at my nutrition right now, I don't even know what my percentages are, but I eat about, I'm just maintaining my weight right now. I currently eat about 240 grams of protein a day. I like protein. That's probably more than I require for, you know, maximizing anabolism, but I like protein. It's satiating. Majority of which is lean meats and dairy. And I eat about, on average, about 360 grams of carbohydrate a day, about 50 to 60 grams of fiber, and I eat about 100 grams of fat. So what I would call a balanced nutritional plan. And really, I try to focus on, what I really try to get people to focus on is, you know, if they want to, if body composition is a consideration, you know, enough protein to recover from exercise and, you know, induce hypertrophy, enough fiber to get the health benefits of fiber, which appear to be quite extensive, actually. And then as far as carbohydrates and then limiting calories to whatever goal you have. So, you know, not everybody's goal is to lose fat. Some people's goal is to maintain or perform better, or, you know, it's as you would know, like with Ironmans, triathlons, hard to perform well if you're in a deficit, you know. So, you know, that requires energy. And for some people, they're trying to gain weight. Like for me, when I was, you know, I started lifting, I was 140 pounds and now I'm 205 pounds. I wasn't going to, you know, maintain my way to, you know, 60 pounds of lean body mass. So it is goal dependent. So I always tell people your energy level, you know, your caloric intake, because calories are not a nutrient. They are simply a unit of measurement. So your energy intake, I mean, literally a unit of energy, your energy intake to support whatever your goal is in terms of your body composition and weight, your protein to support lean tissue and recovery, your fiber to support like overall health, and then your carbohydrates and fats, as far as the research goes, there doesn't really appear to be a big difference in body composition outcomes when you equate protein and calories between different diets. We have a couple of meta-analyses on these now. Now, again, some people prefer a low-carb diet. That feels easy to them. They're able to sustain that. That's great. The only thing I will say is there does appear to be a attenuating effect on hypertrophy for a very low-carb diet. Now, I'm not saying you can't get stronger and grow muscle on a very low-carb diet, so I don't want people to strawman what I'm saying. But they've looked at like higher protein or sufficient protein, so protein-matched, calorie-matched, ketogenic versus non-ketogenic in resistance training, and they see that the people on the ketogenic diet don't gain quite as much muscle as the people on a non-ketogenic diet. So, again, not saying you can't gain muscle, because they did gain muscle. They just didn't gain as much as the people who were on the non-ketogenic diet. So again, what I'll tell people is, for the most part, carbs and fats, you're basically just swapping out different sources of energy. And it appears that as long as you have a sufficient amount of carbohydrate, and it's not a ton, you don't have to have a ton of carbohydrate, but as long as you have a sufficient amount of carbohydrate to maximize anabolism, you can kind of do what you want with carbs and fats. And that's kind of my credo. We set calories first, then protein, and then I look at, okay, what does this individual prefer in terms of like carbs and fats? What do they tend to adhere best to? And then let's, you know, construct that based around that.
So if we were talking about somebody who just wanted to focus on body composition, hey, Lane, I just want to look good. I want to lose fat and just look good. I don't care about health. And then would you... what's your take on calories? Meaning, are all calories created equal? So if you said to me, Louisa, you are only allowed to have 1,000 calories per day. And I said, well, great, then I'm going to have, you know, 2 or 3 donuts and then that's just it. And that's satiating to me. What would you say to that?
So great question. So first off, all calories are equal because calories are simply a unit of measurement. So all sources of calories may not have equal outcomes, which I realize that the question is really like the sources of calories. But I want to make a distinction because I think people get the wrong impression about what calories are. Now, when it comes to that, certainly there are differences. So we know that like protein and fiber, for example, are more thermogenic than carbohydrate and fat. So there's what's called the thermic effect of food. Basically, your body in a way is kind of like an internal combustion engine. You got to put energy in to get energy out. So when you start your car, your petrol in your tank doesn't just spontaneously combust and, you know, your car starts going. Your car has a battery, so you can put energy in to start it, right? So, your body's a little bit the same way in that you've got to put energy in. You've got to use energy to get energy out of the food you eat. Now, you always get more energy out than you put in. Otherwise, we'd starve pretty quickly. Now, there are different TEF values for each macronutrient. Now, it depends on the specific source of each, but in general, fat is about 0 to 3% of a TEF. So, meaning if you eat 100 calories of fat, you get about a net of 97 to 100 calories. Carbohydrates, about 5 to 10%. So if you eat 100 calories of carbohydrate, you get about 90 to 95 calories. Protein is about 20 to 30%. So if you eat 100 calories of protein, you get about 70 to 80 calories. Now that sounds really impressive. However, when you look at like an average diet, if you doubled the protein, it basically works out to like an extra like 120 calorie expenditure per day. Now, again, I'm not dismissing that. That's it matters. But it's not, I will say the biggest determinant is your overall energy intake, right? So just to go for an extreme version of kind of what you just, the example that you gave, again, because I think a lot of people have the impression that like if they're going to lose weight, they can never have, you know, processed food or bad food or anything like that. And I think that can create, I've just seen that create weird associations in people's minds, and people actually, a lot of people in fitness have binge eating problems where because they've created this thought in their mind that this is a bad food and they can't have it, invariably when their will breaks, not only do they have it, they have a ton of it, you know. And I had this issue where, like, when I was first starting out in bodybuilding, I would try to eat clean. And, you know, I was in college, so then my buddies would order pizza, and I ended up plowing through the whole thing, you know. And so I kind of was like, you know, I wonder if it's the whole pizza that's setting me back or if it's just the fact that I'm eating a crap load of calories. So I wondered if I just, tried to track it and just, you know, like, kept it within my calorie goal but allowed myself to have it. You know, and I started doing that, it got really consistent, and that's when I really started to see results. Mm. Now, again, this is just for me, my individual psychology. When I'm allowed to, when I know nothing is off limits, I don't really crave it that much. In fact, I was going to do a debate a while back where, somebody wanted to debate the merits of clean eating versus flexible dieting with me. And so I went to this person's Facebook page, because this is circa 2012 before Instagram got big. And they posted their weekly cheat meal. And I added up the number of calories from junk food from their weekly cheat meal compared to how much junk food I ate during the week, just allowing myself to have it in moderation. And they were eating several hundred calories of junk food more per week than I was, even though I ate like a little bit of junk each day. And I was, you know, going to open up with, so you're saying that if you do it at one time, basically as a binge session, it's okay, but spreading it out and incorporating into your calories is not okay. You know, how does that work? So again, I'm not saying people should eat junk food. I'm not saying, you know, that it's good for weight loss, but what I'm saying is if you look at the studies, so there are, there's one study that sticks out in my mind from 2001, Serwet et al. They had people on 1800 calorie diets. One group was eating over 100 grams of sucrose per day. The other group was eating about 10 grams per day. So a huge difference in sugar intake. And they looked at weight loss.
Were they the same body composition?
What's that?
Like to start with? Were they the same body composition to start with?
Yeah, so they randomized them based on their body fat levels. Okay. So on average, they were the same. So what they saw was, and they put them in this, you know, the same amount of calories. Both groups lost almost exactly the same amount of weight. They both improved like markers of insulin sensitivity. They both improved marker blood lipids. The only real difference between the groups was the group on low sugar had a little bit better improvement in LDL cholesterol, but that's probably because they were eating more fiber, and fiber can lower LDL cholesterol. So now I'm not saying that that's a good idea, because if you're eating 100 grams of sucrose per day, that's not super satiating for most people, right? And again, Dr. Mark Haub, I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he was known as the Twinkie Diet Professor. So he ate an 1,800 calorie diet per day, because he had a bet with his students, and his students said, and actually a survey about 15 years ago that went out asked Americans, what's more important, how much you eat or what you eat? And again, these two things aren't mutually exclusive, so I want to make that clear. But 70% of people said what you eat rather than how much you eat. And so Mark Haub asked his students the same thing. He said, and they said, it's what you eat, most of them. And he said, so do you think that if I ate, you know, in a calorie deficit, but most of it from junk food, you don't think I would lose fat? And most of them said no. So he actually called it a 7-Eleven diet, meaning he was like, pretty much everything ate, you could get at a 7-Eleven. Now, he did supplement with a protein shake, and he did supplement with a vitamin. And he lost 27 pounds, and all of his health markers improved. Now, he said, I don't think this is a great approach for people, because I didn't, you know, one, I just, it wasn't very much food in terms of like mass and volume, you know, because it's calorie dense stuff. But he's like, you know, if we're talking about like, do calories actually matter? Yes, they appear to matter. Now, again, that doesn't mean that the source of calories don't matter either. These two things aren't mutually exclusive. So what I would say is for people, again, I, you know, when I'm looking at a client or myself or whatever, okay, energy based on goals, right? So if I wanted to lose fat, I'd probably drop my calories to like 2,500, 2,700. Right now they're at 3,300, 3,400. Then I'm going to set protein, you know, at a certain amount. Now I'm taking away those calories, right? So let's say I'm in a fat loss phase. Usually I'll bump my protein up a little bit in the fat loss phase. So let's say I start at 2,500 calories. Okay. I'm going to put in about 250 grams of protein. That's 1,000 calories I'm going to take away right there. I'm going to make sure I get about 30 to 40 grams of fiber per day. It's going to be lower on a fat loss phase just because calories are lower overall. And then I'm going to distribute to carbohydrates and fats as I like. Now, if I can meet those fiber goals, those protein goals, and I have a little bit left over and I don't feel hungry, is it okay if I allow myself a little bit of a treat here and there? I would say yes, especially if it helps me adhere to the diet better, you know, and not have as many cravings. And they do show this effect in research where the more you try to restrict something, the more likely you are to have kind of a possible binge response. They call it disinhibition reflex. So I think one of the things I really try to tell people is you can't separate psychology from physiology, right? Like if you tell somebody, if you put them in a room that has four doors and you say, you can go anywhere in this room and you can go in those three doors, but for the love of God, don't go in that fourth door. Don't you dare go in there. Yeah. You will obsess over what's behind that fourth door. It's just how we're wired, right? So what I'll tell people is you don't have to eat junk food. I don't think it's a great idea to eat junk food if you're trying to lose fat. But it's important to understand that you can still have a little bit if you're hitting your calories and lose fat and improve your health markers still as well. So again, I think that's an important distinction to make. Hopefully that kind of answers that question. I realize it's a very long answer.
Well, no, it does. It pretty much sums up what I was experiencing when I was a triathlete. And if my coach said, Louisa, you've got to lose, you know, 2 or 3 kilos before the race, I wouldn't recommend this to anybody, but this was back then. It was in another life. I would just stop eating dinner. Okay. Reducing my calories, but, and I did look, let me tell you, if I was, you know, I ended up very thin, but I was faster on the bike. But I remember I was counting to a T. So I was training, we're doing two sessions a day. I was burning 3000 calories, and that's not just, you know, walking and doing everything else. So probably at the end of the day, I was going to bed 4,500 calories. I reckon that I would burn during a day. And so I would make sure I would say to myself, I would count everything. I would say, okay, if I'm going to go to bed 4,500 calories, Louisa, you can only have, you know, 2,500 calories. Therefore, you're going to be in this deficit. Therefore, you're going to lose some weight. the weight is going to come off you in some form, whether that's through, whether you're losing muscle, whether you're losing fat. I just cared about the weights. And then I thought, well, if that's all I care about, Louisa, you may as well have chocolate if you're not going to eat dinner. And that's what I would eat a great breakfast, a great lunch, and then I would have like a chocolate bar, and then I'd be like, it's fine because I'm only caring about my 3,000 calories or 2,500 calories. So that was what I was really wanting to understand. Really, if you don't care about anything else and you just want to lose quote unquote weight and just reduce your size, then really, it really is calories in, calories out.
Sure, absolutely. And I think most people have a body composition or want to have a body composition focus. Like I think, you know, muscle looks good. And the other thing too is if you don't, there's quite a bit of research to suggest if you don't want to add back a bunch of weight after you lose it, which is what most people do, that you want to maintain as much lean mass as possible. There's quite a bit of evidence to suggest the more lean mass you lose on a diet, it may predict how badly you rebound or how likely you are to regain that weight. So when people say, well, I don't care if I lose muscle, you probably should. And I mean, just as a muscle is a longevity organ. If you look at the research studies in people over age 65, lean mass, grip strength, one rep max strength, very highly correlated to longevity. So, you know, when people say they don't care about their lean mass, I'm like, you're kind of saying you don't care about your health, you know? I think that what I would say is in your situation, I would have said, okay, like if you want a chocolate bar, that's okay, but let's make sure we're hitting our protein and fiber targets as well, just so we're checking those boxes. If you have something left over, that's fine. I liken it to a budget, like a monetary budget. So, and the reason I like it is because I think it's just more intuitive for people. So let me give this example. So I don't think anybody would argue that if you want to save money, you must earn more than you spend, right? I don't think anybody's going to argue that. So if you earn, let's just say you're the average person, I think the average salary in Australia is like $70,000. Over here, it's like more like 55, something like that. Probably about the same thing once you correct for the difference in the dollar. is it a good idea for somebody who makes, you know, let's take loans out just for a minute, just because it makes it a little more complicated. But is it a good idea for somebody who makes $70,000 a year to go out and buy a $50,000 sports car if it means they can't pay their, you know, mortgage or their rent or, you know, they can't pay their utilities? No, it doesn't make sense. But that same $70,000 sports car, if somebody's making $250,000 a year and they can still pay their mortgage, they can put money away for retirement, they can meet their obligations, is it okay if they have some money left over that they want to do that, if that makes them feel good and they enjoy it? I would say that, yeah, that's fine. Now, is it a good use of money? Is it a wise investment? No, but you like part of life is living, you know? People eat, like this is one of the things I tell people, like when people are like, well, this diet showed improvements in satiety and hunger. And I'm like, people eat for, hunger is one of the last reasons people eat, quite frankly. Like people eat for a heck of a lot more reasons than just hunger and satiety. If it was just about hunger and satiety, we would have solved this problem already. People eat because of social cues, because of psychological cues, because they associate certain foods with certain situations. There's a lot more reasons why people eat. And so since there's complicated reasons why people eat, we need to have a multitude of tools that we use in order to treat, you know, specifically obesity or people who want to lose weight. So, and that, again, that's why I'm not a, you know, I have people who do intermittent fasting. I have people who do low carb. I have people who do high carb plant. I have people who do every different like dietary tool in between. But the principles that we use are, okay, if you want to lose fat, we require an energy deficit. I would like you to have enough protein to maintain your lean body mass as much as possible. And let's get enough fiber in, right? And then as far as the other stuff, then we can kind of break it down how, you know, what makes sense for you and your adherence. And the one thing I do want to say is I do hear this comment quite a bit. Well, I ate in a calorie deficit and I didn't lose weight. So let me explain why that's, well, one, that's just not possible if we're talking about over time. Now, you might have ate in what you thought was a calorie deficit. You might have ate in what should have been a calorie deficit. Or weight fluctuations also throw people off with this thing. So let me give some examples. First off, this is going to sound, people get triggered by this, but it's just data. People are horrible estimators of their food intake. Horrible. Absolutely terrible. Like, people don't know that alcohol has calories. It's actually super calorie dense. They're like, oh, well, I had a shot of vodka. Yeah, a shot of vodka has 80 calories. You know, you have five shots of vodka, boom, there's 400 calories.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have any carbs. Yeah, well, the alcohol itself has 7 calories per gram, right? So, boom, right there, there's an extra, you know, 1,000 calories on a weekend that people didn't even know they had. Second, people are, again, horrible estimators of portion size. So they've there was a study where they recruited people who reported that they were weight loss resistant. And all of them claimed to be eating under 1,500 calories per day and not able to lose weight. And when they tracked them in a lab, they were eating more like 2,500 calories. Now, that's very triggering for people because people say, well, I'm not a liar. I don't necessarily think it's people lying. I think that people are just really horrible estimators of their energy intake, right?
Are they using apps like MyFitnessPal, like to track and measure these?
In the study or just people in general?
Well, the people that you talk to in general.
So I think some people do, but again, like somebody goes and pours a bowl of cereal. Let me tell you what, if you fill that bowl anywhere over halfway, what most people think is a bowl of cereal is probably 3 or 4 servings. If you ever want to be depressed, weigh out a serving of ice cream, weigh out a serving of peanut butter. Oh,
don't say
you
that.
Will be depressed. Trust me, because you will go, oh my God, I've been eating 3 or 4 servings at a time. So what people will do is they'll weigh out that bowl of cereal and they'll go in, they'll press one serving, when in reality they had 3, right? They'll have a bowl of ice cream and they'll put in a serving of ice cream, when in reality they had 2 or 3 servings. So there's part of it. And I'll tell people, I don't think people ask me, do I need to weigh my food? I think weighing and tracking everything you eat is a useful experience for a period of time. I don't think it's practical for most people for a lifetime. When I'm home and I have the time, I'll weigh and I'll track just because I can. But what you'll find is that if you do that experience, one, you will be shocked at what you're actually consuming. This is the reason a lot of people don't want to keep a monetary budget as well, is because they don't actually want to see where their money's going. And so you'll be shocked by what you're consuming and how much is actually in food. And the other thing to keep in mind is that people will really drastically overestimate their physical activity. So in this same study, people overreported their physical activity by 50%. And people will say, well, my Apple Watch said I burned this and my bike said I burned that. So these in particular are not Apple in particular, but just watches in general, overestimate energy expenditure from exercise by 28 to 93%. Meaning,
oh my God.
Meaning it might have said you burned 1,000 calories, but you probably burned more like 500 to 700. Okay. So now that doesn't, I still think that these can be useful in terms of like step tracking and even like, for example, when I do a big session and I do squats or deadlifts or something like a really big compound exercise, usually I'll burn like 1,200 to 1,500 calories in that session. Today, I just did bench press and some upper body accessories, and I burned about 1,100. I don't think that either of those numbers are absolutely accurate, but I would be relatively confident that I definitely burned more yesterday than I did today. So that's what I'll tell people they can be useful for. But I'll always tell people, I'm like, what do you think is more likely, that you're somehow violating the laws of the conservation of energy or that maybe your watch isn't reporting accurately? You know, so which one is more likely? And then I think the other thing that throws people is weight fluctuations. So they'll start a diet, they'll take their weight, maybe at a random time of the day. They'll go a week, they'll weigh in at another random time of the day, and they'll say, oh, I gained a pound. See, I ate 1,500 calories and I gained a pound, so therefore calorie deficits don't work. No, your weight fluctuates day to day and throughout the day. So a lot of people don't know this either, that like if you weigh yourself at night, you'll probably be up to 1 or 2% heavier than you were in the morning. That is very normal. And it'll fluctuate 1 to 2% from day to day. So what I do, and actually the way our nutrition coaching app is actually programmed, is if people weigh in multiple times per week, it'll take the average of those. I do recommend, if people can, again, I don't want people to get obsessive about this stuff, but first off, be consistent about when you weigh. If you're going to weigh in first thing in the morning after you go to the bathroom, because that is more of an objective baseline than sometime later in the day. And then I take averages, because while day-to-day will fluctuate, and like I said, this person who gained a pound, they might have on average lost a pound and a half, but they just caught themselves at a high fluctuation, right? They had more sodium the night before. They didn't pee as much during the night, whatever. So I'll look at the averages, because the averages are much less influenced by a single daily fluctuation. But again, these are things that that really throw people when they think they're eating in a calorie deficit, but they're actually not.
Mm. Wow. So many things are going off in my head. I'm wary of the time, and I'm wary of how long we've been going for. I don't want to take any more of your time. I feel terrible, but you know, let's, okay. So yeah, I was going to finish off with...
I can take another question. If you...
Okay, well, good. That's great. Yeah. Because the last part of all of this had to do with, you know, you've grown very big. I have been following you, like I said, for I think 2 years, or the first time that you were on Peter Attia's podcast, and you're growing. And there's a lot of controversy around what you post, which I love, by the way, because I think everything that you're posting is out of the goodwill of spreading good science. And you go out, and I look forward to your, is it the Fridays, the Fitness Fridays, or where you,
what the fitness,
I look forward to those. And what you do is you grab something that has been misled on social media and you say, hey, this is not right what you're saying because of X, Y, and Z. And my question is,
in a very snarky way.
Yeah, it's very smart as well. Are you doing this so you can try and inform people that, hey, these people may be saying something, but it's actually not true? Because that's really big, because my mom, you know, my parents, I love them, you know, with all my heart. And sometimes my mom says to me, hey, Louisa, I saw, you know, this man advertising this vitamin C tablet. Should I be taking it? Because he said it's good for X, Y, and Z. I'm like, wait, what? No. And so when I look at you, I'm like, this is great what you're doing, because the people who are putting out, you know, bullshit really upsets me.
Yeah, I think.
Especially Mark Hyman.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that I really have told people is, I used to think that people who put out really like bad information like this, that they were all just like horrible human beings and they're just like trying to scam people. I've actually backed off that a little bit. I think that there certainly is some of that. And what I'll always tell people is like, this person said this. I'm like, you know, people lie for money. I don't know if you ever realize this, but that is a thing. In fact, people lie for stuff that isn't even money. They'll lie for likes and follows and whatever else. But I think what happens much more is a lot of these people have good intentions. But I always, one of my favorite quotes is, we judge ourselves by our intentions. We judge other people by their actions. And misinformation always has unintended consequences. I always say it's like, you know, even if somebody has good intentions. And a great example is I did a long debunk of Jason Fung. He was on Impact Theory podcast, and some of the things he said, for example, were like, if you intermittent fast, you know, if you calorie restrict, it slows your metabolism. That's true, but he was implying that intermittent fasting is not calorie restriction. And I basically pointed out like, no, I mean, if you're going to lose weight, you're restricting calories by restricting your feeding window. Oh, by the way, here's 5 randomized control trials where they did intermittent fasting. They lost weight. And guess what the difference in metabolic adaptation was between normal calorie restriction? Nothing. It was that they had the same amount of metabolic adaptation. So, but people would say, well, you know, who cares if it's not technically accurate, because, you know, it's going to help a lot of people. There are some people that it's going to help. you don't hear about the people that it harms, okay? So there's a lot of nutrition tribes out there. And those people, if they kind of say like, oh, you know, like this didn't work for me, or I had this thing or this thing happen, what happens is they end up getting shamed really badly, and people are afraid to say anything. I knew a lady who came to me, actually, she had been a part of like low carb Facebook groups. I'm not just picking on low carb. This goes for any nutrition tribe. So I'm not just trying to pick on low carb. And she had said, hey, you know, I've kind of like developed like an issue with binge eating, you know, in this Facebook group. And the messages she got were so nasty. Like somebody called her a disgusting sugar addict and like all this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, basically people, I think one of the problems is people make like whatever nutrition thing they like part of their identity, which is why you'll never see me have like flexible dieting coach in my bio or like protein something in my bio, because I don't want to, like, it's not part of my identity. That's not part of who I am. Like my diet isn't part of who I am. It's something, you know, it's something I do. It's something I research, but I don't want to pigeonhole myself into a position where if it becomes my identity, then if it ever gets like, if information comes out suggesting it might not be good, now I'm stuck with trying to like, do I get rid of this identity or do I just completely omit this research that's out there? Right. So I think this is a big problem with people who are out there, and like even right down to like saying, oh, you shouldn't have sugar. Well, what is the extreme problem? You know, well, people say, well, what's wrong with that, Lane? Like, even if, you know, like you show this information that you can still lose weight if you eat sugar, what's wrong with telling people to eat less sugar? Or what's wrong with telling people like sugar is bad for you and it's inflammatory and all this other stuff? And I'm like, well, the problem is that people don't – when you're not putting proper nuance with it, people become very black and white. And guess what happens when they have any kind of sugar at all? A lot of them will end up binge eating it. And I know I keep going back to the binge eating thing, but I'm very sensitive to it because I've worked with over 2,000 people, a lot of them physique competitors. And I would estimate over 50% of the people I coached had issues with binge eating at one point of their life or another. And it's funny, I always tell people, I'm like, do you think like the 10 grams of sugar you had is worse for you? Or do you think an eating disorder is worse for you? Because I would argue that the eating disorder is worse for you. So I'm just really careful. If you've noticed, I'm really careful with when I explain about how something works, because I don't want people to draw this association in their mind of this is the only way and you know, shouldn't do it this way. And again, like the unfortunate thing is misinformation. It takes seconds for it to spread like wildfire. It takes 20 times, 100 times the effort to unravel it and debunk it. So I'll give you an example. I did a really long debunk. Well, it didn't start out as a debunk, but that's what it ended up being, of Paul Saladino's appearance on the Joe Rogan podcast. So
yeah, I saw that.
That was a 3-hour podcast. It took me 8 hours to listen to the podcast because I had to stop it probably every 10 seconds when a claim was made and write down the claim, write down, you know, like, and then, you know, start it back up. It took me 8 hours to listen to it. Then it probably took me about 40 hours to write. No, actually probably more than that. It took me about 40 hours to write the bulk of it. But after I referenced it and everything, it was probably closer to 60 or 70 hours. It was a 48 page with 280 citations, basically going over, you know, these different claims and which ones were true and which ones were false. So his appearance was 3 hours. My total time in was probably about like 80 or 90 hours. Like, you know, you're talking about like multiples of time to, and of course it didn't even get spread to as many people, right? Because it's not on the big podcast. So I think that, you know, it's really tough to be in the position of somebody who really like sticks to the evidence, because I call out everybody. I don't care if you're a vegan. I don't care if you're a fasting person. I don't care what, if you make false claims, you know. Let me back up. I usually don't pick on people who just like say something wrong necessarily. Typically, it's somebody who's shown like a progressive habit of misrepresenting research. And this happens. And the other thing to keep in mind is like people say, well, this person wrote this book and there's all these studies they cited. And I say, oh, yeah? Did you actually like click on some of the studies and look them up and see if it actually said what they said it said? Because like a great example is like Dave Asprey a few months back did a video where he was talking about artificial sweeteners, and he said, oh, there was this study where they gave artificial sweeteners, and he was talking about all the stuff it did, and he said, and then it caused him to gain body fat and all this kind of stuff. So I went and looked up the study. So first off, it was in rats, which is fine. but it actually showed that the rats getting the artificial sweeteners like lost a significant amount of body fat compared to the other group. So not only did it not say what it said, what he said it said actually the opposite thing. And we know from our website that, you know, like I said, the Paul Saldino article had 280 citations. Of the people who visited, less than 1% clicked on even a single citation. So again, it's one of those things where, you know, just because somebody cites a study means nothing if you don't actually go through and look at it.
That is wild. And sometimes I think, why would somebody like Dave Asprey, like what benefit does he get in by quoting a study about artificial sweeteners if it's not even correct? Like, to me, that's just like, wouldn't you want to is he trying to point people towards to go and buy the stick of butter or whatever it is that he's trying to sell? it's just mind-boggling.
I think once somebody has tied themselves, so one of my, hopefully this doesn't get me in trouble, this statement. I always say, you can date your hypothesis. You should date your hypothesis, but don't marry it. Mm. Don't make that hoe a housewife. Like, because if you get married to your hypothesis, the divorce is a bitch.
Yeah.
So you really want to be careful about planting your flag really strongly, right? So when you, if you have made really strong statements and you've made really strong claims and you've built your brand around some of this stuff, it becomes really difficult to walk that back, right? So, and I always say, like, you know, when you get to that point, when you're just defending a position in the face of overwhelming evidence, that's not what scientists do. That's what politicians do. So, you know, again, I look at what I do as like with the debunks as kind of like a little bit of a public service. But I do, listen, I'm not going to lie. Part of it is, yes, I'm trying to get licks. I'm trying to get likes and I'm trying to get shares and I'm trying to get follows, because that stuff is important to my business. Mm. Yes, I want to make money. I'm not, you know, I'm a for-profit business. But I don't care about I don't care about any of that more than I do about like educating people. And so that's why I'll also tie it with, okay, they're wrong, and yes, I'm making fun of them, but here's why they're wrong, and here's the research, and you know, here's the links to the research, so you can go and check for yourself.
This is amazing. I think that everybody should go and do your – so let's just tell me where we can find you, because right now I know that for another day there is a free ebook about literally how to read research. It should be How to Read Research for Dummies, but it's plain, it's simple, it's there, and then – as of what, next week or tomorrow, it's going to be a paid thing?
Yeah. So people, it'll probably be up for a little while longer. You can go to the link in my Instagram bio and get it. Also, it's on my website, biolane.com. Mm-hmm. And Biolane is where you can find me pretty much anywhere on social media. Yeah. And then I look at Instagram as kind of like the business card now, right? So if you click the link in my bio, it'll take you to all the stuff we have in terms of like our supplement line, our nutrition coaching app, Carbon Diet Coach, which is available on iOS and Android, our workout builder, which are customized programs that we've written, our research review, which is coming anytime now. We're waiting on the launch of our new site, which should be any day now. And then our educational books and the How to Read Research Guide. If people don't get it while it's free, it will be available in our store as well. Or if they subscribe to REPS, our research review, they'll have access to it there as well.
This has been absolutely amazing. Hopefully next time we'll get you on and we'll probably do 5 hours next time. But Lane, we're going to link everything you spoke about and thank you for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.